Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
What's up, what's up, what's up? Welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II based podcast. And we are back for 2024. We got the whole new gang back together. Joining us, as always, from the big-ass State and Union, as we were discussing prior to going on the air, Mr. Jeff Copsetta. Jeff, how you doing, sir?
Great, great. I'm pumped about 2024, pumped about the new show tonight.
And also joining us from the ranch. Actually, no, he left the ranch. Now he's at home, but formerly from the ranch. Formerly a guest of the show, multiple guests, but now a new host, Mr. Dennis Blocker. Dennis, how you doing, sir?
Doing great. Doing really great. It's good to be with y'all.
I like that shirt. I like that shirt.
Yeah, check it out.
Just a little state of the show for you guys. As you guys know, Henry took some time off to work on his book. And as you would assume, that's a long process. And so we wish Henry well and hope all things go well with his book. But even after his book gets released, which we have no date on that, but after his book does get released, there's tours and all that stuff. So he's going to be tied up for a very long time down the road. And so I'm sure he'll come back as a guest from time to time. But we're going to keep on trucking on as we've been doing for the last, holy hell, 6 years now? Yeah, 2018 is when the show launched. January 7th of 2018, because that's what the logo stands for, on Mr. Blocker shirt. Did you know that, Dennis? Look down on your shirt. That's the US-01, stands for January 7th, 2018. That's what that stands for. That was the date our very first episode aired, and now you are part of the family and the history of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast.
That's pretty cool.
So Jeff was telling me you guys have been busy. You got a little project you're working on.
Yeah, we've got several things that we've been going over the last couple of weeks in pretty intense meetings, hashing out ideas. Some of them are actually ideas we got from the war years, and we're pretty excited about it.
Jeff?
Well, we also got another project that Dennis is a huge part of that he just kind of invited me to help out. I was hoping, Dennis, you'd talk a little bit about our boy Arthur Allen Jr. and the potential of that project, the potential of a guest to come on the show, and the potential of just everybody. I mean, I don't know what it is. There must be something on TV, but everybody loves B-17s now all of a sudden.
Yeah, something in the air. It's just weird. I don't know.
Something is in the air for sure.
Yeah, so that project is something that we were I did a book with Mitch Weiss, a Pulitzer Prize winning author, and called The Heart of Hell, about my grandfather's unit, gunboat unit, specifically LCI gunboat 449 in the Pacific. And we work really well together, and I learned a lot from that process about writing, and he went in turn took advantage of my research skills that I had been doing for so long. Well, we were approached by the nephew of a B-17 pilot from the 94th Bomb Group, 332nd Squadron, and he asked if we would be willing to write about his uncle. And you know, of course, you're like, well, there's so many stories out there. What makes one rise to the top above, you know, the literally almost unlimited numbers of stories that are out there? And so we're just, you know, fingers crossed, hoping that there would be a story there. Well, you know, it turns out that, you know, the B-17 crew was, you know, tremendous. Like, guys were writers, writing home these great letters. The compelling, even Walter Winchell mentions this bomber crew in one of his radio broadcasts. They were a special group of guys, and we're looking forward to telling their story. And, you know, I of course reached out to Jeff with his experience with the air war, specifically Europe, and you know, to be able to have a resource, especially somebody that, you know, you care so much about and spend so much time with, you know, to be able to sit around and sit around a fire, and which we've done. And it's not just like a fanciful idea, but we've actually done it, sat around a fire and campfire outside and just pad and paper and just hashing out stuff. And it's been really great. You know, it amazes me that even after all of the work that I've done and the research that I've done, it amazes me that there are still stories to be uncovered. I don't know why it amazes me, because I know that, you know, but there's still nuggets out there. And
I was just thinking the same thing. I'm like, isn't it amazing how there's still so many stories untold? But then this voice in the back of my head's like, hey, stupid, do you realize how many men served in this war across the world? Clearly, there's a lot of stories out there that are untold. But how lucky are you that in this day and age where, sadly, it's sad, it's weird, but it's not. And I know it doesn't make any sense, but I'll make it make sense. Sadly, there's less veterans around. But as Jeff and I were talking before the show, it was only 80 years ago. And those cats were between the age of 18 and 17. So now they're going to be 97, 98, which then does make it more understandable to believe that there's not so many around. But the fact that I've often said, the older I get, the younger old gets. And so when you're 16 and 17, you think, wow, 67-year-old guy, that guy's old. But when you're 45, you're thinking, this stuff happened 80 years ago, 83 years ago. Most people have grandparents that are still alive that are in their 70s and 80s. And that makes you realize how not so long this was ago. And then if you want to go deeper in that, you're thinking, well, that was 80 years ago. World War One was a few years before that, which would have been in my case, my great-grandfather's era. And then if you keep going back, Civil War, Revolutionary War, and then you kind of realize how young our country truly is.
Right.
It's like, wow, that our country was founded six generations ago, like six grandfathers ago or seven. Right. You know, it really makes you realize how young we are and how not so long ago that was. But then once you add that 18 on it, now they're 98 years old and they're less and fewer around. And so now we're at that point where we have to rely on the children and the grandchildren carrying on those stories for those who aren't around anymore. And we have to rely on those people's wives, sisters, and cousins, hopefully at some point, as in the case of your grandfather, relatives taking all their letters and have stashed them somewhere, and then someone finding them, not knowing they're there. Like, oh, I cleaned out grandma's, or I cleaned out my mom's basement and found my grandfather's letters to my grandmother's, and now here's all this new source material. And that source material's popping up all over the place, assuming, you know, people's grandparents' stuff was tucked away in a basement somewhere. Perfect example, we talk about my grandfather all the time. Every time I reach out to my mom, my aunt, hey, you got anything on my grandfather? Oh, it's in your Uncle David's basement. Okay, so I'll have to wait until Uncle David gets around to clean out his basement, I suppose. But and that's how a lot of this stuff gets unearthed. One day someone finally does that spring cleaning and, oh, look what we found.
Yeah.
And then you got to find some enthusiastic person like you and Jeff to bring it to life, put it in paper, and make it available to the world.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty exciting, really. When the World War II veterans were still with us and alive, it was still a challenge, because your challenge was to get them to talk about it, you know, the worst day of their life in many cases. But, you know, I had a really different kind of a bearing about me, that these guys just all opened up to me and just trusted me with their stories. But what I think that even more interesting now is, as far as like from a researcher point of view, is the being very ingenious and the different routes that I'm having now to get the story from, specifically exactly what you said, that now we're having to reach the family members, right? So you have to now, I have to convince family members that who have been bombarded by calls from India every day and calls from the spammers and all this scam that's going on.
I'm Amazon. Time. Someone bought an iPhone for $900. You need to call me.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, your Sprint thing is expired. If you don't respond within 24 hours, you're going to be canceled. You know. Mm-hmm. Now here comes this guy from Texas. And I want to talk to you about your grandpa. It's like, okay. So you have to, it's intriguing because it's something that I love, and because I get very ingenious on how I'm going to convince them to, talk to me about it. And, I've been successful at that, but that's just, trial and error and learning, specifically, if anybody out there is interested and has a story that they want to research, I mean, whitepages.com will give you people's phone numbers and it will give you their email, which really blew my mind. But it's been successful. That's how we've got these guys from this book that we're working on now.
Let me ask you a question from a research standpoint. I just had this thought.
Yeah.
As we get older and as living historians and reenactors, you're kind of seeing it now, at least here in Florida, I'm seeing more young cats who are reenacting Vietnam and what tends to happen as the grandchildren get to that age, they oftentimes want to reenact the scenarios in which their grandfathers or their fathers fought in. Obviously, you guys are researching World War II, some point maybe some Korean stuff, but all the writing home, all the communication was done, handwritten letters, probably all cursive, right?
Yeah.
For majority of it.
Yep.
Jeff, when you were overseas and Dennis, when you guys did correspondence, you guys all handwrote your letters, correct?
Yep.
All in cursive.
Yes, absolutely.
Jeff, no?
Yeah, no, Jeff, I know where you're going with
Jeff
this.
Was doing black letters, double spaced, triple margins with the blue line through the middle.
I write in all capitals, much to the chagrin of all of my students that they tell me that I write like I'm yelling at them. Why do you write in caps lock? there's a reason.
Well, Dennis sees where I'm going. They're not teaching cursive nowadays. So 30 years from now.
That doesn't even matter because who's writing a letter?
Nobody. But when the next group of amateur historians, the next Dennis Blocker, the next Jeff Copsetta, right. The next Jared Frederick, who's going through your generation's letter, writing back from, Iraqi Freedom, Operation Desert Storm, all those conflicts, and they're cursive, they're going to have to, I got to take this home and scan this into my computer with some software that recognizes cursive writing because I can't read this in real time because I never learned cursive writing. And just, I don't know, I just don't know if that would take kind of the personalization out of the research or it's just something they're going to be used to.
Dennis, you probably could answer that better, but I just throwing this out there. Like, I think that kind of stuff happens all the time when you come across acronyms for different things or just the vernacular of the day a lot of times needs to be translated. I don't think that's anything new for research. You go, whoa, wait a minute. I've never come across that, the way he described that or whatever. Because, there's military, just the verbiage is different. Just like it was. I mean, I don't think that somebody at the turn of the century could look at a letter from a Civil War soldier and go, what does that even mean? And it's probably just, shortening the word regiment, for example. But if you don't know, the chain of command in the military, I think civilian researchers still have that a little bit of a block there. What do you think, Dennis?
I get that, but I guess maybe what my point is I'm assuming, and I don't know because I've never had the privilege or the benefit, but I'm assuming that when Dennis is sitting down reading a letter that's handwritten, there's a little personal feel to it because you're reading this. Perfect example. Back in the day when CDs came out, you'd go to the music store, you'd buy the CD, you would open up the catalog, and sometimes the lyrics were typed out, and sometimes the lyrics was a photocopy of Kurt Cobain's handwriting or Trent Reznor's cursive handwriting. And it to me, it felt more personalized. It felt cooler. Like, oh, I'm reading it straight from his hands, his mind, because you're reading a copy of his cursive writing opposed to some intern typed it out at the CD company. I'm just wondering, when it comes to research, do you feel more personable when you're reading someone's handwritten letter versus a transcript of said letter? And will that be lost by a generation of researchers who may not be able to read the actual personal handwritten letter until it's been transcribed into a text that they know how to read? I guess is kind of my point.
There's the UDT frogman on the LCI gunboat 449, Lee Yates. He was observer from Team 14 on my grandpa's gunboat for the EWO mission. He was killed in action. His stepdaughter, she sent me all of his wartime letters. It's about almost 200 of them. And they're all the originals. And you cannot help, as a historian, you cannot help but know that this paper traveled with him all over his journey. And it was in his hand. It was in his hand. And that pencil, that lead, left the pencil because he specifically pressed down with a pencil against that very paper I'm holding in my hand. And that transfer from his brain through the pencil to the paper, all of that mechanism is right there and I'm holding it. And to your point, Don, that letter is very powerful to me. And I can transcribe them. My nephew, for this past Christmas, couldn't read his Christmas card because I wrote it to him in cursive, and he's 22 years old. And I think that's what you were gleaning that more earlier, is that these letters, these simple letters that I have from Lieutenant Yates, Seth would not, if he was a historian, he would not be able to read 200 letters quickly. It's going to be something where he's going to have to hire somebody, an expert,
or
scan them into a computer and hope that this software is picking up on all the different intricacies of the different way that people form the letter F, or the people form an H, or
the pesky
everybody
Z.
Has their own little things that you learn.
And to that point, when you're reading through letters, you can read it in real time. Okay, this is kind of cool, but it's really not going to fit my narrative. I'm going to put it aside. Now you got to take it all home, scan it, take that time, read it before you, oh, this is nothing. And so sure it's going to make the whole procedure take three times longer.
And what if you're a historian on a budget and you have to hire an expert and you've got 200 letters? Well, you don't know which ones have all the good key stuff that you want. Maybe you can decipher by date. That might help you a little bit and narrow it down by, I'm looking for a time period between March. One specifically in regard to the book that I'm working on now, I'm really looking for letters that would be from March 1943 to July 1943. So, in that regard, I would be able to cut down 200 letters into maybe, 50. But then, if you're on a budget, you've got to hire an expert, right?
Time is money.
That's it.
Another cool thing about what you were saying about having that letters in your hands, it's one thing to think this paper was there, this paper's now in my hands. But if you're a history nerd like we are, a military history nerd, not only did he write that, not only did he press that, but he put it in an envelope, handed it to the guy who's collecting the mail, and then it got put on a ship or a plane. And just the fact that not only did he write that, but just the logistical machine that it took to get from point A to point B, and all that happened during that history that you love so much. Wow, this thing possibly flew on this particular plane, or maybe this traveled here via a Liberty ship and then got processed here and then went there, and the whole mechanism of it, if you're truly into it, that's that in and of itself. How many goofy little things do we, I got a postcard that somebody got that, or I got a poster that hung in somebody's drugstore and then put in an envelope that I bought off of eBay 10 years versus this actually got sent to so-and-so and it went through the whole system. I mean, if I'm that happy to have a poster from somebody I didn't know that hung in a drugstore, how cool is it to have those letters that actually went through that whole mechanism? So just depending on who you are and what you're into, the value just changes.
Yeah, that's such a good, that is so cool. And you could even write a short story about that. You could write a short story about a really interesting short story about the journey of a piece of mail.
You could say, okay, who was responsible?
From the perspective of the letter.
What was the chain of command? Who? I mean, we've all seen movies about the airborne. We've all seen movies about First Infantry. We've all seen movies about the Navy and Air Corps. Don't see a whole lot of, I haven't seen too many documentaries on the mail carriers, the people who got the letters home, who was responsible for making sure V-mail got sent and the microfilm, the whole thing. That may turn in itself into a cool book or cool documentary. There's a group of people that were valuable to the war effort who maybe never fought, shot around, but they got that. You guys know nothing affects morale more than a letter from home or knowing that your letter got home and how important those guys who made sure that that happened all the way across.
I'd skip a meal to get a letter. Every time. I'd skip a meal to get a letter from home when I was over there. Absolutely. But I think what you're talking about is nothing new. I mean, there's always had to be some type of translation or an expert brought in that, you know, who could read Latin. You know, I think about the Rosetta Stone. You know, I don't think that that's anything that historians haven't already had that challenge for thousands of years since we've kept written record, right? I mean, since the Phoenicians, there's been dialects and translations and improper translations.
Yeah, right.
Cursive is just going to enter into that realm. You know, you make a great point. It shouldn't. It's not like it's a whole separate language that's never been spoken again, but I don't think it's anything new, you know, for historians to deal with a barrier of some sort. You know, I think about the Bible, how many times the Bible is translated.
I agree, but it's just so annoying that it's an obstacle that we put on future historians. It doesn't have to be there.
But to that point, let me ask you, a lot of those languages took hundreds, if not thousands of years to die out. Cursive died out in what, 8.5? I mean, it's a pretty quick deletion on that key. I mean, yeah, Sanskrit, Latin, some of that stuff, 500, 600, 700 years.
Don,
cursive.
Nice. This is these are the letters from there's hundreds here, at least a couple hundred. Just randomly picking one up.
And you're located where in Texas are you? You're like in the middle of the state, right? You're near Jeff.
I'm in San Antonio.
Okay, perfect. So you're nowhere near the coast. You ain't got to worry about hurricanes and flooding and losing all that stuff. That's what I'm worried about. It's like, okay, you're in the middle of a landlocked state. It's safe.
Right, exactly.
Because, I mean, I live in a town where, you know, my father lost everything he owned. Sad story. I kicked myself in the ass. I should have stole it when I had the chance. Never did because I respect my father. But in high school, you know how every once in a while you go looking through your parents' crap? I saw in my dad's jewelry box back in high school, he had his father's Navy dog tags, the round ones, just like our Marine Corps, said Donald Preston Abernathy on it, which is my name. I would be a third, except for my dad didn't have the same name. He had that thing, and then after Hurricane Ian came and flooded and put 4 feet of water in his house, he found the jewelry box. Dog tag was gone. If I would have stole that damn thing back in 1997 when I found it, or in 2005 when I reaffirmed it was what I thought it was, it would be safe here. But because he had it in a flood zone, got washed away in Hurricane Ian, history lost, along with his guitars, all his he had road pianos because he plays in a band, all, mixing boards, all, everything lost. And so nowadays when I think of historical stuff, I'm like, when you show me that box, I'm like, God, I hope you don't live on the coast.
No, I don't. I live, and another thing too is I am mindful of even water leaks. Like things aren't never on the floor; they're in totes that are covered. I just super, super scared about.
Crazy as it sounds. Not during Ian. Well, Ian, everything's already consolidated in this room, but during Irma, a few years before that, when they were talking about potential flood, my dad and my stepmom were here. I took all my valuable stuff in case we had to get on the roof and put it in this room, and my M1 Garand, none of my reproduction shit, but some of my true-to-life historical stuff, I picked and chose a few things that if we had to get on the roof, I felt it had historical enough value that it was going on the roof with us. I had it all here consolidated in one little spot because, you know, we've been through 5 hurricanes now. But, you know, it's that's one of the things that some people don't put into consideration. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was gonna say, I just have a thought.
Mm-hmm. Send all
don't
my stuff
live
to you
in
guys.
Florida.
You got room.
Throwing that out there.
Well, you know, sadly, I had to go back to Ohio because a friend of mine I went to high school with passed away at 42. And it was right after the hurricane, and I was back here talking to somebody. And someone mentioned, it's like, well, you know, I've lived in Ohio my whole life, never had a tornado. What are you living in Florida for? And I just said, hey, man, there's a cost of living in a free state. I just left it at that because I remember seeing all the news stories about Ohio during the pandemic and how everything was. I was like, there's a price of living in a free state, and I just left it at that. So yeah. Real quick, because I know people are wanting to know, Masters of the Air. We know Jeff hasn't seen it. Dennis, have you seen any of it?
I have. I saw the 2 episodes.
I have not. And here's why. I've mentioned this in the past, not with Masters of the Air, but just I personally, I don't have Apple. I can get it again. I'll just do what I always do, just get the trial, binge watch things, and then get rid of it. But I kind of made the conscious decision, especially after seeing everything being inundated with Masters of the Air stuff. I'm going to let it die down a little bit and pass because I mentioned this before. If you don't buy into all the hype and get caught up in all the hype, you're less likely to be let down. And since I haven't seen any, I'm not saying I will be let down, but I figure if I just kind of let it die down, get rid of my anticipation, and then I can go into it with a calm heartbeat and clear mind and just enjoy it for what it is and not saying, oh, here's the new one, here's the new one, let's go. I've been waiting 5 years for this, waiting 10 years for this. We've been talking about it on the podcast every other episode for last year and a half, and then possibly be let down by it. So I'm just going to kind of chill out, let everybody do their thing, and go watch it with a steady heartbeat and a clear mind and maybe binge watch all of them once they're out and available. To that point, without giving away spoilers or anything like that to our audience, you've seen the first 2 episodes, you said?
Yeah.
What is your initial giveaway on what you've seen so far?
It's really good. Yeah, it's really good. And I think that as historians and folks who love the subject, but also as folks that are mature and have life experience, that we know that they have to take some license with things because to move the story along, and they have to combine characters into one, and they have to combine events sometimes to move the story along faster because they've only got, you know, 8-10 episodes, whatever it's going to be. So, you know, you just have to be mature enough to realize that it's not going to be, you know, exactly accurate, this and that. But I really enjoyed watching it. And yeah, there's some shots in there just from cinematography point of view, there's some scenes in there that will live with me like my whole life that were just absolutely beautiful.
Since you've seen it, I've gone through this review and I've edited out anything that would be considered spoiler alerts. I don't know if this gentleman got early access to the entire series or if he's just basing this review off the 2 episodes he's seen. This is from a website, cbc.ca. It's a Canadian news entertainment site. The gentleman's name is Jackson Weaver. I'm just going to read this modified version of his review and let me know if you think he's way off base. He's kind of got some points, and just as your as our resident person who's seen those two episodes where Jeff and I haven't, I just want to throw this out there and let me know where you think. It's kind of long, but it's kind of I did edit it down. So this is by Jackson Weaver, CBC News. Band of Brothers, the HBO war miniseries about the American paratroopers produced by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, began with a short narrative hammered to the skull. Quote, we came from a small town, a small, small town, says a combat veteran immediately off the top of the first episode. All three fellas in that town were deemed unfit for duty, committed suicide because they couldn't go. 9 years later, the next entry, the United States Marine entered the Pacific, only took a few extra seconds to get the similar point. Quote, we had no idea what we're in for at all of this, a retired Marine said, over images of ships burning in Pearl Harbor and FDR's, quote, a day they'll live in infamy speech. The main thing was we were all alive. But Masters of the Air, the producing partner's third and latest installment, takes a significantly different route. Rather than launching with footage of soldiers, battles, or history, the series starts off with two guys, Buck and Bucky, leaning on an elbow at the bar, riffing over the similarities between their nicknames. Now, to be fair, framing Masters of the Air as a flippant, with its subject matter, through a young Air Force struggling through some of the darkest days of World War II would be disingenuous. The opening scene purpose is to starkly contrast between the pilots' experience on the ground with their screaming descents through machine gun fire and sub-zero temperatures more than 6,000 meters to the air. As a scene showing just that pops up moments later, any impartial watcher would say Masters of the Air treats its source material with respect, based on the book of the same name by Donald L. Miller. The series obviously committed to truthfully telling the story of its fighters, such as the 100th Bomb Group members. Like the book, the show pairs personal stories with terrifying realities of air combat never seen before or since. It's more than understandable that the series, filmed now, nearly a century after its subject took place, no longer includes firsthand testimonies as its predecessors did. But without them, Masters of the Air takes a completely tonal shift. Where Band of Brothers commentary and the Pacific's tactical maps and missions outlines bookend each episode help track a certain sense of similarity and awe, Masters of the Air has given over completely to just another story using historical context for entertainment. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but it's a significant downgrade and especially disappointing if your standards were set so high by the last two miniseries. Watching Band of Brothers, Easy Company slowly build a fighting force and to get to Europe, then to see it picked apart as real members recollect what it was like to be there, it was almost like a service journalism. It was an eye-opening peek into history you could play in history class. Masters of the Air's less impressive story, for the most part, made a disjointed antidote from the book, patched together without a unifying theme, feels like something you would watch while making dinner. It's a shame for the fact that it's a compelling story to be told, committed, but overzealous. It's a shame for the fact that it's a compelling story to be told, committed, but overzealous commanders were arguably forced by circumstances to sacrifice airmen in order to provide Air Force, could prove that the Air Force could and must be used to win the war. There was also a refusal of the planners to accept the necessity for fighter planes alongside heavy bombers and the threat of the Army Air Force being absorbed and disappeared into the untested techniques that didn't show results. Some of this is scattered throughout Masters of the Air, but without a clear focus of one or the other series. Instead, Butler Cleaver's delivers wooden lines which still hold on to the accent that seemingly seeped into his pores from his 2022 portrayal of Elvis. Meanwhile, he bounces between impressive but samey sky battles and the real-life accounts of a hand melted into guns and a husky named Meatball, which was kidnapped from Iceland. It's a